Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larkin, Judge Cochran, Judge Gaetis, the Honorable Michelle A. Larkin presiding.
There we go. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this session of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The date is January 7th, 2021. We're having our hearings this morning on the Zoom platform. The procedural rules are the same. Each attorney will have 15 minutes for primary argument. Appellant's attorney will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal argument. You'll see there's a timing mechanism up in the corner of the screen, so please pay attention to that in terms of the time remaining for your argument. And also please do pay attention to the judges. When they have a question, they'll do what they can to get your attention, so please be mindful of that. At this point, I'd like attorney for the first case, Madison Equities Incorporated versus SEIU Minnesota State Council. Would attorney for appellants introduce himself for the record and begin your argument? We'll give you 2 or 3 minutes to state the primary points of your argument, and then maybe we'll ask you to pause to see if there are any questions at that point. Please keep in mind, we're familiar with the facts of the case, and if we do have any questions regarding the facts, we'll ask, and we'd ask to the extent possible that you focus on your arguments in the limited time that you have with us this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, everyone. My name is Justin Cummins, and I'm counsel for the appellants in this case. This appeal concerns respondents' two claims, tortious interference and defamation per se. I'll address each of those issues in order, but I would like very briefly to emphasize the governing black letter law, given this is an interlocutory appeal regarding the court's subject matter jurisdiction. Garmin preemption must be applied broadly. That means Garmin preemption applies whenever a claim concerns conduct that is at least arguably protected by the National Labor Relations Act, or arguably prohibited by the National Labor Relations Act, or otherwise arises from a labor dispute. A labor dispute is similarly defined in exceedingly broad terms. It is literally defined as, quote, any controversy, unquote, related to terms or conditions, even when the disputants are not in an employer or employee relationship. That means that Garmin preemption applies to a union's public criticism of an employer's pay practices. It also means that Garmin preemption applies to a former employee's public criticism of an employer's pay practices. With that brief overview or summary, I can turn to the specific claims here, Your Honors. If you want to-
But before you do, I have a couple of questions for you about the application of Garmin. You say it must be applied broadly, and you say it applies to any labor dispute, and labor dispute must be defined broadly. I'd like to take a few steps back, because as I read the case law, the U.S. Supreme Court case law, it's pretty clear that Garmin preemption only applies if the conduct at issue, that is the conduct that's the basis for the legal action, falls within either Section 7's protection or Section 8's prohibitions. And I'm trying to understand how the conduct at issue here arguably falls within either of those provisions.
Correct. Your Honor has stated the law accurately. And the conduct at issue here is speech that ultimately is critical of the alleged pay practices of respondent. And that is quintessential Section 7 activity.
How so? Could you explain that with reference to the text of Section 7?
Well, the text of Section 7, like the text of Section 8, actually does not spell out in detail the type of conduct that is deemed to be protected. The National Labor Relations Board precedent does, however, as does United States Supreme Court precedent. We've cited several cases.
Counsel, can I interrupt you there for a second?
Yes.
You said the text of Section 7 doesn't outline the protected conduct. Can you explain that?
It doesn't.
And maybe I didn't properly quote what exactly how you stated it, but can you explain that thought?
Yeah, and that's how I heard you say it. I'm looking at the text of Section 7, and it lists with great specificity the type of conduct that's protected. So could, I too would like an explanation for your assertion that we can't look to the text of Section 7, we look only to case law.
Oh, actually, that wasn't my point, Your Honor, that you can't look at the text. What I was saying is that the precedent, the National Labor Relations Board precedent, provides a lot more detail about what is deemed to be protected activity under Section 7. And that includes, and we cited a number of cases in our briefing, including the Wild Oats case. The pin site for that is 336 NLRB number 14, page 181 to 82. And that talks about how a union's public criticism of an employer and including pay practices is actually protected, not just arguably, but actually protected by Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act. In addition, the Saigon Gourmet case we cited, which is the pen site is 353 NLRB number 110 at 1, talks about how employees' complaints about wage underpayment, or basically criticism of an employer's pay practices, is actually protected by the National Labor Relations Act, Section 7 specifically. And the truth is, if employees or unions or other interested parties couldn't address alleged wage issues, if that wasn't protected by the NLRA, as a practical matter, the NLRA would not provide a meaningful protection, because often the disputes between an employee and an employer are related to wages, not exclusively. In fact, we cited U.S. Supreme Court precedent, the Washington Aluminum case. The pen site for that is 370 U.S. at 15, where the issue was the temperature of the workplace. And that was deemed to be a labor dispute. That was something that the employees were complaining about, and that came within the scope. So the scope of what constitutes protected activity itself is broad, but garment preemption says even if it's not actually protected, just arguably protected, or for that matter, arguably prohibited, then garment preemption must apply.
All right, let me ask you this then. Let's assume, for the sake of this argument, that this is arguably protected conduct. It seems that the case law is pretty clear that a defamation action is, as a matter of law, an exception to garment preemption. And if this conduct is arguably protected, all it means for the defamation claim is that there's a heightened pleading standard. It doesn't bar the claim, it just raises the bar on the pleading standard. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. To maybe put a finer point on it, garment preemption still applies, but it will not bar the court's jurisdiction if the plaintiff satisfies the heightened pleading standard. And the heightened pleading standard has two components. There must be sufficient facts to show actual malice, and there must be sufficient facts to show actual harm in the complaint. And actual malice is defined as knowingly false or with a high degree of awareness of probable falsity.
As to the damages, the case law seems to indicate that a claim of general damages is sufficient. Do you disagree?
Generally speaking, that is what the Lynn case seems to say. However, we cited subsequent Court of Appeals decisions interpreting Lynn, which said that, for example, describing the employer as treating employees like slaves did not cause actual harm. Describing the employer as, or employer representatives as, literally as Nazis did not cause actual harm.
Okay, but here the accusation is the employer has violated the criminal laws, which is usually defamation per se.
That's not actually correct, Your Honor. Well, first of all, to be clear, the speech at issue simply states that that employees of respondent have alleged that they have not been paid wages they're owed, and that they are pursuing those claims to the Attorney General's office. And that, as a matter of public record, has been confirmed. The district court's own record shows that. And in fact, my understanding is that the parties have been litigating that issue before the Court of Appeals as well. The the allegation about waste theft that the employees have made is not an allegation of criminal conduct. Waste theft is generally understood as an assertion that an employer is not paying wages that they're owed. It only becomes a criminal matter if the employer is proved to have done so with an intent to defraud or something along those lines. But as a general matter, waste theft is generally understood as a civil matter. In fact, the statutory regime that pertains to waste theft that is cited by respondent, most of the provisions that are cited are civil in nature. We discussed that in our brief, and I can go into more detail if you want about that, Your Honor.
I'm not sure the track we're on with this argument, so I kind of want to bring you back a little bit. In terms of the exception or the heightened pleading standard, the question I have is, if defamation is as a matter of law accepted, that is, it doesn't preclude litigation so long as the heightened pleading standard is met, why wouldn't the second claim of tortious interference fall within that same exception if it's based on the very same conduct? Do you see what I'm saying? If you have one set of facts, the publication of these documents, and we label them defamation, they fall within the exception. But if we label the same facts, tortious interference, why wouldn't it fall within the same exception for the same reasons that the exception is applied to defamation claims?
Because both the U.S. Supreme Court and the Minnesota Supreme Court have been clear that claims along the lines of tortious interference are absolutely barred by Garmin preemption.
Exactly. But the Minnesota Supreme Court said that, I think it was Midwest Pipe. They said that, but in that case, the underlying conduct did not involve speech. It involved threatening somebody in terms of contract. So yes, tortious interference can fall or is not necessarily within the exception. What I'm asking is, why wouldn't it be within the exception for defamation if it's based on the very same conduct that supports the defamation claim?
Again, Your Honor, because the U.S. Supreme Court has been clear that the only exception to Garmin preemption is for a defamation claim. Like
I'm not sure of that, because in the Sears case, the Supreme Court provided a list. This court has held that state jurisdiction to enforce its laws prohibiting violence, defamation, intentional infliction of emotional distress, or obstruction of access to property is not preempted by the NLRA.
That's correct, Your Honor. And those are the time-honored exceptions recognized by the U.S. Supreme Court and by courts of appeals for decades. But there is no recognition that an exception applies to tortious interference claims.
I agree. But what I'm asking you to address, if you can, is why shouldn't the exception apply if the conduct that forms the basis for the tortious interference claim is the exact same speech that forms the basis for a defamation claim? I mean, we have the same conduct with just a different label. Wouldn't we not put form over substance if we said, well, yes, this conduct falls within the exception for the purpose of the defamation claim, but not for the tortious interference claim, even though it's the same conduct raising the same public interest?
To answer your question, I think it's important to take a step back. Garmin preemption exists as a doctrine to prevent courts from interfering with national policy. The Court of Appeals, in a published opinion entitled Wright, which we cited in our briefing, and the pin site is 686 Northwest 2nd, 3223. The court in that case, now it wasn't a defamation case, it was a case involving breach of contract, fraud, unjust enrichment, a whole litany of claims, not tortious interference, but a whole litany of state law claims. And the court, in reversing the judgment for the plaintiff, reiterated that, and this is a direct quote, courts must defer to the exclusive competence of the NLRB to avoid the danger of state interference with national policy. Okay.
Let me ask a question on that, counsel. The case law, including the Supreme Court case law, talks about preemption this way. Well, you can't have preemption unless the conduct at issue could be addressed both by the National Labor Review Board and the state court. How is it that the conduct at issue here could be addressed by the National Labor Review Board? In other words, how does Madison Equities obtain relief from the National Labor Review Board for this conduct?
Yes, Your Honor, the respondent could have filed an unfair labor practice charge with the National Labor Relations Board challenging the conduct of the appellants. And to be clear, one of the appellants is actually an employee of respondent during the relevant time. The National Labor Relations Board would investigate the charge, make a determination, and if the National Labor Relations Board determined that there was merit, the National Labor Relations Board would prosecute a complaint.
And what would the claim be? How would relief be sought? Where would it fall within 7 or 8 of the NLRA?
Well, I can't speak for sure for the respondent, but I would imagine the respondent would argue that the conduct was similar to the Midwest Pipe scenario where the union allegedly disparaged the employer and interfered with the employer's ability to do its business and harmed its reputation and so forth. And that constituted a threat or other undue influence or coercion in violation of Section 8 of the National Labor Relations Act.
How does the conduct here fit within that description?
Well, arguably, the respondent would certainly say and appears to have said in this litigation that the speech of the union and the employee has harmed the reputation, has disparaged the name of respondent and cause undue coercion or imposition on the employer. And I mean, I'm not going to say that the claim is valid or meritorious, but again, it's arguably within the scope of the National Labor Relations Act.
All right, thank you, counsel. Your time is up. We'll now hear from the attorney for Madison Equities. Sir, could you introduce yourself for the record? And we'll give you a few minutes to outline your arguments for the court, and then we may interrupt you at that point with some questions, okay?
Okay, thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Mike Mather. I'm an attorney in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I represent Madison Equities, Inc., in this case, the respondent. May it please the court. In this case, the appellants, two self-proclaimed labor organizations and a former employee of the respondent, asked this court to accept its request for blanket immunity from regulation of its actions by the state courts. The issue with this request was made clear by the United States Supreme Court back in 1945, when the court proclaimed that labor unions cannot claim special immunity from regulation. Appellant's request today not only runs foul of that proclamation, it's also contrary to a decision of this court issued just 9 months ago, when the court rejected remarkably similar claims under remarkably similar facts. Simply put, the federal Garmin Doctrine does not apply to this case. By the express language of the Garmin Doctrine and subsequent decisions of the United States Supreme Court interpreting that decision, Garmin is expressly limited to actions that are protected by Section 7 or prohibited by Section 8 of the National Labor Relations Act. As made clear, there are no claims in this case that arguably implicate either section, and as a result, the preemption argument fails. Garmin simply does not apply. But more fundamentally, even if this court were to accept appellant's argument that Garmin may apply, their motion for judgment on the pleading still fails as a matter of law because Garmin contains an express exception for defamation claims and tortious interference claims alleged in the manner that they have been alleged in this case. Again, just 9 months ago, this court affirmed the denial of a similar motion for judgment on the pleadings, finding a similar complaint with similar claims arising from similar statements fit within this exception and therefore could continue to discovery. There is absolutely no reason this court should reach a different decision today. Instead, the court should affirm the district court in all respects, making three findings in the process. First, this court should affirm the district court's finding that Garmin preemption does not apply to these claims because they do not implicate a Section 7 right or a Section 8 prohibition. Second, this court should reaffirm the exception to the Garmin Doctrine for defamation claims and tortious interference claims when they meet the actual malice standard. And third, this court should affirm the district court in finding that the claims alleged here meet that heightened pleading standard and therefore may proceed to discovery. Now, turning to the first issue, as the court has already...
Before you do, this is Judge Larkin. You've mentioned a couple of times an unpublished case of this court, and I assume you're talking about the Gorman case?
I am, Your Honor.
All right. I have a question about that case because it seems that we went straight to whether the heightened pleading standard had been met. And one of the things we relied on was the plaintiff's assertion that Mayo Clinic had investigated the SEIU complaint and advised defendants that it had thoroughly explored the allegations involving Carol Gorman and found no evidence to substantiate the allegations. And without providing any evidence to support the complaint, defendants continued to repeat the false and defamatory allegations. And to me, that seems like a pretty clear assertion that the defendants knew the allegations were false or were reckless. What in plaintiff's complaint here meets that heightened pleading standard? In other words, what assertion says, look, appellants knew this was false or should have known it was false, and yet they went ahead with these allegations?
Yes, Your Honor. The first thing I'd like to address is the court is correct in that the Gorman decision did jump right into the heightened pleading standard analysis. I don't know. I was not a party to that case, so I don't know if the issue on just if Gorman applied at all was raised. So I'd note that that is slightly different from this case. But turning to your question on the issue of actual malice, yes, there are those statements in that case that focuses on the actual malice element. I think the potential interpretation to limit Gorman or the defamation exception to such explicit issues when they knew the statement was false or certainly recklessly were unsure if the statement was false would be a little too narrow. Because if we look at the Lynn decision of the United States Supreme Court, there's a footnote in that case, it's footnote 7, that actually talks about in a little detail this actual malice standard. And it talks about in broad terms, knowing the statements were false or at least reckless with regard to the truth or falsity of the statement. But in that footnote, it actually rejects an argument from one of the parties there that wanted to even further narrow that exception to what it called grave defamations. And then it listed a bunch of things that it constituted grave defamations, one of those being an allegation of criminal conduct. So even if the court would find that these allegations, and again, we're at the pleading stage, we haven't had a chance to really develop all the facts and exactly what was known when, but even if the court wanted to limit it to these simple issues, the mere fact that wage theft is defined by Minnesota law as a criminal act, there is a theory under Minnesota's law that says that allegation is or that statement is an allegation or an accusation of committing a crime, which fits into what Lynn called the grave defamation standard, which is a subset of the actual malice. So it's kind of saying all grave defamations fit actual malice, but not all actual malice accusations are grave defamations. So it was, I think, a potentially slightly...
That argument... would eliminate the exception. I mean, the exception says for defamation, you have to plead that the defendant either knew it was false or was reckless with regard to the truth or falsity of the statement. And now you're saying we should take it one step further and say, if the alleged defamatory statement alleges criminal conduct, that's the end of the analysis. We don't look at whether the speaker knew it was false or was reckless with regard to the truth or falsity. Is that what you're saying?
It's part of what I'm saying. And I'll look to Lynn first, because that Lynn case does say, it was the government who had argued in that case that it wanted to limit liability, limit this actual malice standard to only those grave defamations. And it was accusations of criminal conduct, homosexuality, treasonable actions, or other infamous conduct. And the Supreme Court said that that would encroach upon the state jurisdiction far too much and limit the exception far too narrowly.
Okay.
So
it sounds like what the footnote says is we're not willing to limit the exception to those types of cases.
To just those types of cases.
Right.
But okay. The implication from that is those type of cases certainly fit within the exception. It's not only those cases fit in.
Well, the exception. I think it's apples to oranges. I mean, the Supreme Court saying we're not going to limit this exception to only this type of case is very different than the Supreme Court saying, and if it's this type of case, you don't need to plead knowledge of falsity or reckless disregard of the truth or falsity, which is what you seem to be arguing. That's what concerns me. It seems, I mean, you're saying, well, here's the heightened pleading standard, but you don't need to meet that standard if it's one of these types of cases, simply because the Supreme Court said it wasn't going to limit the exception to those types of cases. I'm not following the reasoning or seeing the connection.
Your Honor, and again, I'll get back to the actual knowledge in a second, but I apologize.
The question I have is, what would you point us to in the pleading that satisfies the heightened standard, assuming that plaintiff had to plead that the defendants knew their assertions were false or acted recklessly with regard to the truth or falsity of their assertions?
Well, it would turn back to the mischaracterization of the status of these other issues. You know, the whole basis for the statement comes back to this idea that there are allegations that Madison Equities has violated the state's wage laws. And that just simply is not true as a matter of fact and as a matter of law. I think that the other case, the other district court case, is beyond the record in this case. But if we would actually look at it, what the Attorney General's office argued there vehemently is that there are no allegations of wage theft. The only issue pending before the court in that case is the scope of the civil investigative demand it issued. It's trying to engage in some discovery to determine if allegations and if there is a potential for a violation of wage theft law. But in the briefing in that case, the state made abundantly clear no allegations have been made. There are no pending charges. No one has asserted that these things have any merit. We are simply investigating to see if they do. So that
Mr.
knowledge
Mather,
is part of, yes.
Is it appropriate for this court to consider pleadings in that other case, given the standard of review here?
Your Honor, I don't think it depends. You know, I don't think going beyond the record is really appropriate here on a motion for judgment on the pleadings. The appellants have attempted to do so and to recharacterize the allegations to fit it into a box and narrow those allegations. But again, this all goes back to the issue of Minnesota being a notice pleading state. The Minnesota Supreme Court has said over and over again that the purpose of pleadings are to put the defendant on notice of the charges, so the parties then have an understanding of the claims when they proceed to discovery. Again, the notice pleading standard also.
So what specific allegations in the complaint would you point to in response to Judge Larkin's question earlier?
Looking briefly at the complaint, certainly paragraph 29, paragraph 30, stating affirmatively that there have been no there have been no unpaid wages.
Here's the thing, counsel. What we're looking for is not a denial of the allegations, but some assertion that supports a conclusion that the allegations were made with knowledge of their falsity or reckless disregard of the truth or falsity. I mean, I understand that the complaint denies the truth of these allegations, but how does the complaint meet the heightened pleading standard that requires, you know, some assertion showing knowledge of falsity or reckless disregard?
Your Honor, there are those allegations contained within the defamation count. I apologize. I'm trying to quickly scan through to find the specific paragraph numbers right now. But paragraph 41 pleads explicitly that they had actual knowledge or a deliberate disregard for the truth or falsity of the statements. 42 also does so. There's a litany of paragraphs that allege affirmatively that the statements are false.
Let me ask you this, counsel, as I understand enhanced pleading requirements, I'm thinking, for example, of fraud cases. I mean, Minnesota's a notice pleading state. But when you get to an enhanced pleading requirement, it's not enough just to put someone on notice, I think, by saying, we allege they knew this was false. Don't you have to provide a little bit more in the complaint that supports that assertion? Isn't that the purpose of enhanced pleading? You need more specificity than is typically required for general notice pleading?
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe that specificity is there. But if it's not, I think the remedy in this case is then to ask is to provide leave to amend the complaint to add that specificity. That opportunity has not been provided because that's simply a pleading issue. And if those facts exist like we think they are, then it's simply a matter of amending the pleading because we aren't actually at this point in the case determining the merits of any claims or the merits of any defenses. This is simply a preliminary proceeding where we're identifying what the claims are and what the defenses are. So the parties can then actually proceed through the process of building those claims and defenses. The merits of the issue will be litigated later on in the case after the parties have had an opportunity to conduct that discovery and build the case. So to the extent it is lacking in any way, which we don't believe it is, I believe the correct remedy, instead of just dismissing the case on the merits and not allowing Madison Equities to attempt to prove up its claims, is to provide leave to add those allegations. Because again, Minnesota simply is a notice pleading state.
Okay. And counsel, I think you've made your point, so I want to interrupt you again. Time's limited. Would you please respond to appellant's argument that precedent from the National Labor Review Board, Wild Oats, Saigon, states that a union's criticism of pay practices is protected conduct under Section 7, which triggers the Garmin preemption.
I think the first thing is to start with the plain text of the statute. Let's look at what Section 7 says. And if we look at the plain text of Section 7, the very first word in it is employees. Section 7, by its very nature and the plain language of the statute, is explicitly limited to the actions of employees and their right to engage in collective bargaining efforts. This case was pled very intently to not include any Madison Equities employees. It is an unaffiliated or two unaffiliated entities and a former employee who voluntarily terminated his employment several months before these events.
The citations we've been provided. So are you just saying, well, yes, there's some precedent out there saying a union's criticism of pay practices is protected, but that precedent is wrong given the plain language of Section 7?
No, Your Honor, that was going to be my second point, is I think the appellants mischaracterized those decisions. Okay. If we look at those decisions, and we've gone through each of these decisions and we put it in our brief, it's footnote 13 on page 15, but each of those cases identify a specific Section 8 right that has been implicated by that case. Wild Oats specifically identified Section 8A, 8A1, and 8C. Saigon, And I apologize, I couldn't catch the name of the third case, but I did note that appellant in both Saigon and that other case explicitly talked about the actions of employees. It was not unaffiliated entities or former employees. Those dealt with complaints of actual employees, which then does implicate Section 7 because they are employees. And then again, Wild Oats is Section 8A1 and 8B. And then Midwest Pipe is 8B4. But again, we've gone through each of those cases that appellants have cited, and we put it in that footnote to identify the rights that have been put at issue there. So again, just to conclude, Your Honor, we believe the district court correctly determined this issue. The Court of Appeals should affirm it in all respects, and this case should proceed to discovery. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your answers to the questions. All right, Mr. Cummins, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal argument. Oh, counsel, you'll need to unmute yourself. No worries, it happens all the time.
I apologize. Thank you, Your Honors. I misspoke about Saigon, Gourmet, and Wild Oats. It's correct that those pertain to employee criticism of the employer's pay practices. But I can give you a number of US Supreme Court and Eighth Circuit cases, as well as NLRB cases, that talk about union conduct, union criticism of employers as being protected by the National Labor Relations Act. And
Mr. Practice. Cummins, I have a question about the universe of facts that a court is allowed to consider in making that threshold determination of whether Garmin applies. In other words, are we limited to reviewing the complaint, or can we look at the answers, or can we go more broadly beyond those pleadings in determining whether something implicates Section 7 and 8, or arguably implicates those sections?
Thank you, Your Honor. According to Minnesota Supreme Court precedent that we cited in our briefing, judicial notice can be taken of publicly available records. That is appropriate and frankly furthers judicial economy. And here we have the district court's publicly accessible records, which confirm and we included it in the addendum at page 20, that the Attorney General's office concluded even at this early stage while being denied all of the employer's time and pay records, that the wage claims that appellant Lewis and other employees are pursuing through the Attorney General's office appear to be meritorious. And that really ties into what is the speech at issue here. I think it's really important to recall what is actually being said. And we quote all of the speech that's at issue on page 6 and 7 of our opening brief. And all of that speech is about allegations by employees. It's not saying that the respondent actually didn't pay wages owed. It's saying that employees are alleging this and they're pursuing those claims through the Attorney General's office, which the district court's publicly available records confirm is true. If I may just briefly return to the question of garment preemption applying to union conduct, so you have the sites, that they're in the brief, but just so that you have them handy, Austin 418 US at 279, Rodney Shipping 397 US at 201, Beverly Hills Foodland 39 F3rd 194 to 97, and Polly Drummond Thriftway 292 NLRB at 331 through 333. Those cases all address in different ways situations where the union is criticizing the employer publicly and that conduct is deemed to be protected. We talk about it at greater length.
Mr. Clemens, if I may.
Yes.
Mr. Mather argued that footnote 13 of his brief explains that each of those cases specifically involve either Section 7 or Section 8 of the National Labor Relations Act. Do you disagree with the citations in his footnotes? In other words, do you disagree that the cases that you just cited us to, which I believe are included in that footnote, all involve either Section 7 or Section 8?
No,
we
agree that garment preemption applies, and garment preemption applies because either the conduct of the union was arguably protected by the NLRA or arguably prohibited by the NLRA.
Well, I'm sorry. Let me drill down on that a bit. I think earlier Judge Larkin asked you to identify which specific provision of the NLRA was at issue here, Section 7 or Section 8, and I don't think you pointed us to any specific language in either Section 7 or Section 8 that was at issue. In footnote 13, respondent seems to suggest that there is specific language in either 7 or 8 that's at issue in those cases. So is this case different than the cases that you just cited us to in that regard?
If I'm understanding your question correctly, this case is not different in the sense that the union and the employee are seeking to address employment terms or conditions, and they're criticizing the alleged pay practices in that context. Seeking to address employment terms or conditions is quintessential protected activity, that is to say, covered by Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act.
So what language in Section 7 would you point us to then?
The language
that I guess that's what I'm struggling with.
Right. The language that pertains to, and I don't have Section 7 in front of me at the moment, unfortunately, Your Honor, but the language, generally speaking, that pertains to an employee's right to engage in concerted activity. And that has been interpreted by the U.S. Supreme Court and the National Labor Relations Board to mean that a union trying to help an employee address employment terms or conditions is protected by Section 7. So a union and
the pleadings, the complaint doesn't actually, well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead, Your Honor.
So what does it matter that the complaint doesn't allege that Mr. Lewis is an employee of Madison Equities?
It should not, Your Honor. As a practical matter, he was an employee during the relevant time. That's a matter of public record. That's something that the court can and should take judicial notice of. It's frankly being a little cute with the pleadings, that the public record is clear that employees during the relevant time asserted that the employer respondent did not pay wages owed. That is a civil violation. It's wage theft. It's a civil claim. And they, in fact, are pursuing those claims through the Attorney General's office, which is a matter of public record through the district court's own record.
In the language of Section 7, it's unfortunate you don't have it in front of you, but what it says is employees shall have the right to self-organization, to form, join, or assist labor organizations, to bargain collectively through representatives of their own choosing, and to engage in other concerted activities for the purpose of collective bargaining or other mutual aid or protection. So I wonder if in those cases, you know, we had circumstances where statements were being made in that context, in the context of union organization, in the context of collective bargaining. But we don't have any assertion that there was an attempt at union organization here or collective bargaining. So how does this, the facts before us fall within Section 7?
Right, Your Honor. I mean, as a practical matter, the union was in the process of organizing, but I understand that's outside of the pleadings.
Right.
But you don't actually need to have, and the cases don't actually say you need to be technically in an official organizing campaign. You don't like to represent the employees. I believe.
And I think what the case is, the Supreme Court case I'm thinking of, says you don't have to be within the context of an official campaign, but you do have to be attempting union organization or organization of the employees. It doesn't have to be official but it has to exist.
Well, some of the cases that we cited, and offhand, I don't recall which of the ones I cited to you a few minutes ago, including Austin, don't involve a formal organizing campaign. It's where the maybe it's the Arredondo shipping case. I don't recall offhand, all but right. Where the union is criticizing the employer regarding their employment practices in any number of respects. And it could be part of an organizing campaign, but not necessarily. The point is, it's about a labor dispute, which is defined as any controversy. And if it's a labor dispute, and to quote or to paraphrase the Eighth Circuit that we quoted in our brief, which is Beverly Hills Foodland, as long as it's not like the speech isn't about some sort of political or social issue, it's a labor dispute. And if it's a labor dispute, then Garmin preemption applies.
All right. Thank you. We appreciate the arguments and the briefing from both of the attorneys. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll have our decision within 90 days as required by statute.